This is, for the record, program number 891. How might Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty have viewed Edward Snowden? Subtitled, Think Different. The foxes aren't guarding the hen house. They are the hen house. An update on the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook. This is being recorded on February 25th of the year 2016. Hi there, boys and girls. Guess what time it is? That's right. It's time for another exciting episode of the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, your favorite cartoon character. Remember, boys and girls, Eddie's not like those other spooks. They're scary and mean. Eddie is your friend. Well, as the introduction obviously indicates, this is an update on the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, the man I also call the Peach Fuzz Fascist, and the Obverse Oswald. That last nickname, I think, will be brought into clearer focus in this program. One of the most important and incisive analysts of and critics of the malfeasance or the bad elements, it's a corny word, of U.S. intelligence is was Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Prouty, who retired in 1964 and passed away many years ago, was a colonel in the U.S. Air Force, and he became what was known as the focal point officer. One of the things that he did was to set up focal points for the CIA to infiltrate, co-opt, and control other elements of the U.S. government, including and especially elements of the U.S. military. And what we're going to be doing, probably again, passed away many years ago, we're going to be taking a look at the Snowden operation, L'Affaire Snowden, as I call it, from the perspective of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. We're going to begin with a roughly half-hour excerpt from the Guns of November Part 1, part of the four-part Guns of November archive series that I did back in 1983 about the assassination of JFK. This program was recorded on November 1st of 1983 and also features my incredibly charming and vitally intelligent co-host, Nip Tuck. What we're going to be talking about is the U-2 incident. In May of 1960, on the eve of a summit conference between then U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, a U-2 spy plane went down over the former Soviet Union, and the uproar over that led to a cancellation of the summit conference between Khrushchev and Eisenhower, which was pointing toward a cooling of, a deceleration of the Cold War. It was aiming toward basically reducing Cold War tensions and aiming at detente. The U-2 incident beat six that and led to instead to a perpetuation of the Cold War and frustrated the attempts of both Eisenhower and Khrushchev to bring things to a more stable and intelligent state of affairs. Note that just as President Obama was going to meet with President Xi of China, Edward Snowden decamped to Hong Kong and leaked information about NSA spying on China, thereby frustrating Obama's efforts at improving relations with China, and in particular arriving at an accord about U.S. and Chinese spying on one another. Then just as Obama was going to be meeting with Angela Merkel and the leaders of the EU, Glenn Greenwald released information from Snowden about NSA spying on Germany. They viewed Germany was the most spied on country in Europe, thereby damaging U.S. relations and Obama's relations with the EU and Germany. Then, on the eve of a summit conference between Obama and Vladimir Putin of Russia. Snowden decamps courtesy of WikiLeaks, who also appears to have gotten Snowden from Hawaii to Hong Kong specifically. The individual who is implicated in getting Snowden from Hawaii to Hong Kong is a guy named Jacob Applebaum, whom we will be talking about. Just before Obama was going to meet with Putin for his summit conference, Snowden decamps from Hong Kong to Moscow courtesy of WikiLeaks. That led to a cancellation of the summit conference and the end to Obama's State Department's attempt at rebooting relations with Russia. That was followed immediately by the Maidan covert operation, which led to the installation of the World War II-era fascists of the OUNB in Ukraine and everything that has followed. We're going to listen to The Guns of November, Part 1, and information from L. Fletcher Prouty's book, The Secret Team, the CIA and its allies in control of the U.S., and the world, and also Operation Overflight by Gary Gentry and Gary Powers, the pilot of the U-2 plane. This again from The Guns of November, Part 1, from November 1st of 1983.
Now, the first segment that we're going to be presenting comes from a book called The Secret Team by Fletcher Prouty. Why don't you give us the publisher and publication date. It was copyrighted 1969, and in soft cover it was published by Ballantine Books. So The Secret Team, CIA and Its Allies in Control of the World, authored by Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, soft cover Ballantine, 1969.
Okay, and this tape is originally excerpted from The One Step Beyond of September 4th, 1983. Of the world hung in the balance somewhere between these earnest plans for peace, they're talking about the summit conference, and the miles remaining ahead of that U-2, Francis Gary Powers' plane, as it neared Sverdlovsk. This was not the normal U-2 flight. Much was made of the fact that the pilot had with him a vial, a needle of poison, so that rather than expose his native land to charges of willful violation of the airspace and sovereignty of the Soviet Union, he could silence himself in death. The code of the spy. Yet little was made of the antithetical fact that the pilot also had a parachute which would save his life. Much was made of the fact afterwards that this was a, quote, civilian aircraft, and that it was flown by a, quote, civilian pilot. Yet this pilot had been permitted to carry with him on this flight his military identification card, complete with name and picture, along with a pocketful of other identifying cards, all of which easily placed him at military installations, in military instrument flight schools, and on military facilities just days before the flight. He was hardly a deniable spy. Much was made later of the fact that Air Force Captain Powers had resigned from the Air Force, and that he was a civilian employee of the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation. He was technically a civilian, but his records were still held by the Air Force, and had he chosen, he could have returned to the Air Force without loss of pay, seniority, and promotion status. Furthermore, the number of identification items that he had with him made it clear that he was less a true civilian and more a civilian cover spy pilot. He was in the same mold as Alan Pope in 1958, who was captured by the Indonesians, and of the Air Force crew that was shot down in Armenia, also in 1958. By that time, the Russians had plenty of evidence to know that, quote, civilian pilots belonged to the CIA by way of the U.S. Air Force. This course of events had more impact upon the United States than upon the Soviet Union. The U.S. government made much of the fact that the U-2 was, quote, an unarmed civilian aircraft, and that it was flown by a civilian. However, in his book, The Craft of Intelligence, Alan Dulles makes much of the fact that the operation of such sophisticated aircraft could scarcely have been kept a secret. It wasn't. As he wrote, quote, sooner or later, certainly this would have leaked out. Since this was so certain, then why did the U.S. government have to give out untrue cover stories? And why do they have to permit Powers to carry so much identification when it would have been better to limit the leak as much as possible? Even if he had died, they would have had all the information they needed. How did it happen that they broke with policy procedures for that special flight by letting him take off loaded with incriminating evidence that proved he was a U.S. spy pilot? Who was it who wanted this special U-2 flight on May 1st, 1960, 2 weeks before the summit conference, to fail, and then to become so glaring an admission of guilt when it did fail that it would inevitably doom the summit conference along with it? The incidence of these things, too many things, give weight to the thought that this flight was intended to be something rather special. Nothing was said that all clandestine operations personnel, and especially the select coterie of U-2 pilots, were required to submit to a complete inspection before takeoff, which included the removal of all clothes and other personal effects, and the issue of sanitized, non-identifiable clothing and equipment sufficient only for the flight. Neither pilot nor plane were sanitized on this flight, as was required on other flights. Skipping on down. When the plane went down, its signals faded, and it was lost from tracking radar. The engine had stopped, and Powers was gliding the plane down from its extreme altitude, which was so high that the air's oxygen content was insufficient to support combustion. The normal combustion of the jet engine at that altitude had to be assisted by the infusion of a trace of raw hydrogen from a small liquid hydrogen cryogenic storage bottle. If by some chance the engine either coughed itself out, or if something happened to this slight hydrogen supply and the engine flamed out, it could not be restarted at that altitude. The pilot would have had no recourse other than to let down and see if he could restart the engine at some lower altitude. The evidence that the engine would not restart even at 30,000 feet indicates that the trouble was most likely hydrogen deficiency and not a normal fuel flameout. Had it been a simple flameout and had there been plenty of hydrogen, the engine should have restarted, as others had in similar circumstances. When the plane did not restart, Powers was forced to let it continue to spiral toward the Earth, and then, at a safer altitude, either bail out — a high-altitude bailout is dangerous and violent — or continue on down to the ground. Actually, some of the early pictures of the U-2 showed an aircraft that was relatively undamaged, when one considers that the Russian story was that it was hit by a rocket in the air and then crashed into the ground. We may never really know whether Powers parachuted because he was hit by Russian rockets or gunfire, or whether he parachuted simply to leave a plane that was doomed to crash anyhow. The elaborate pictures of the plane, which the Soviets released at the trial, show neither bullet damage nor rocket damage. Although at that point, neither would be important. The plane was going to come down. If it had not been on the way down, neither rockets nor bullets would have been able to bring it down in those days. Okay, skipping ahead. The Russian premier — this is, of course, Nikita Khrushchev — was ready to say, quote, "We are so close to the summit and to peace. I am ready to accept that this was a cruel and terrible provocation made by others without the knowledge of the American president." Then, out of quotes, "Let the president stand up and say that he had no knowledge of this flight, and then back up his statement by firing Alan Dulles, Dick Bissell, and those other four men who had pressed so hard for this flight. This was the challenge, and that was the price." There was still a chance that Ike could have his long-dreamed-of summit conference, but now he would have to pay the price. Thus, Eisenhower was put to the biggest test of his entire career. Could he clean house? Could he rid the country of those who, as Harry Truman said, quote, "had diverted the CIA to become the center of foreign intrigue"? Or would he have to bend to their might and their cunning and see his dreams shattered in a cold and cruel awakening? Many years later, it was President Richard M. Nixon who said, quote, "when you inherit a nightmare." And that was as far as he went with his thought. President Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs, had the same nightmare. President Eisenhower had come within 2 weeks of achieving not only the goal of an aging president who had given his entire adult life to his country, but of realizing the hope of the entire country for a lasting and hopeful peace. No one will ever know just why he turned down Khrushchev's gambit. No one will ever know why he decided to back the ST at a time when it had permitted his plans to be shattered. Did he simply believe that his course was the only honest way out and that someone in his administration had made an innocent mistake? Or did he succumb to a greater pressure? It was not only the U-2 that had trapped him. The ST had armed and equipped a major force of tens of thousands of Tibetans high beyond the Himalayas. Now, the ST refers to the secret team, and this is the policymakers at the top of the military and the intelligence monoliths, I guess you could call them. It was not only the U-2 that had trapped him. The ST had armed and equipped a major force of tens of thousands of Tibetans high beyond the Himalayas. It had thousands of Cubans under arms and in training all over the North American continent, from the Canal Zone to many sites in the United States. It was deeply entwined in the politics and economy and rebellions of Africa. And already the United States, which had seldom seen armies in its own streets, was becoming accustomed to the roar of heavy trucks and the march of feet in embattled inner cities. Did Eisenhower really have a choice? Could he just fire Alan Dulles and a few of his top lieutenants and clean house that simply? he knew that he could not. Those other men who had seen to it that all the little things fell into place, and that the U-2 had gone aloft on that precise day, were men of the secret team, and wiping out Dulles and his staff would not touch them. Furthermore, it was one thing to have the power to see that the U-2 was not stopped from going on a rather routine flight, but it was an entirely different matter to be able to assure that it would come down in the very center and heart of the Soviet Union. Skipping ahead for the last part we're going to read here. The president may have realized that he was not really in charge of events, and he could not honestly say that he didn't know what was going on. Yet he had never seen the picture in its totality before. There was no other way out. President Eisenhower did the only thing he could. He announced to the world that he had known about the flight and that it had been his sole responsibility as Commander-in-Chief of the United States. With that, Khrushchev had no choice but to face the same facts his way. How could he hope to reach a peaceful settlement and meaningful agreements with a president who was admitting to the world that at the very time he had been speaking peace, he had been plotting overflights and the invasion of the territorial integrity of not only the Soviet Union, but of China and Tibet and Cuba? Khrushchev had no alternative either. All hopes for a successful summit conference had gone. The leaders of the world attended the conference individually, but all was lost. With this great disaster, the 15-year search for a peaceful settlement in a world menaced by the atomic bomb came to an end. Vietnam lay ahead. Now, that's a rather complicated bit of information, and probably, and to hearten those of you out there who are reeling from all the information on the U-2 spy plane, which you might not have been familiar with, that's probably the most complicated bit of information we're going to be laying on you in this show tonight, at least as far as getting in tune with things. To go back and touch some bases real quickly, Dave, you might want to explain about the U-2 and how it all came to pass in the first place and some things relating to it later on and how we're going to bring it back in.
Oh, okay. Now, the U-2 basically was put together by the CIA and Lockheed Corporation in order to fly over the vast territorial expanse of the Soviet Union and bring it all under U.S. surveillance. U.S. intelligence had been notoriously bad at getting agents inside the Soviet Union, so they turned to technology basically to solve that problem. And the U-2 had been flying for some time over the Soviet Union performing espionage missions, and it's worth noting that the U-2 flew much higher than any existing plane, interceptor aircraft, or anti-aircraft guided missile that was possessed by either side in the Cold War at this point, so that there is no way that the Russians could have shot the plane down unless it went down to a lower altitude. Now, summing up very briefly what Prouty had to say there, so that the information is front and center. Basically, first thing, the summit conference basically was deep sixed by the failure of the U-2. In other words, Khrushchev and President Eisenhower were going to be getting together and attempting to work out some sort of peaceful resolution to the Cold War. The U-2 scratched that. Now, President Eisenhower had given specific orders that no plane, no act be taken by any element in the U.S. military or intelligence apparat to jeopardize the peace conference. Now,
let's also make a couple of other things clear real quickly, which is, first of all, President Dwight Eisenhower, despite his own military background, was the first person to warn the United States and its citizens formally about the military-industrial complex. Dwight Eisenhower, in fact, said that the greatest danger to the United States in the upcoming years would be the growing supremacy of the military-industrial complex in its participation in national life and national policymaking. Another key point, unless any of you out there have missed this, I want to make this clear, because since we jumped into the technicalities, we did not make the overall thesis of this as clear as it might have been. There is no doubt that there was spying going on both sides. The mere existence of the U-2 is not in and of itself the thing that we're pointing to. There is no doubt in anybody's minds that both sides were doing their best to spy on each other. What we are talking about here, and what Lieutenant Colonel Fletcher Prouty is in fact charging, is nothing less than a betrayal of the U-2 from within by what he calls the secret team. Again, the top men in intelligence and the military complexes. A betrayal of this particular U-2 flight from within, so to sabotage this upcoming conference. Okay, and that's specifically what we're talking about here. Not the spying itself, but the fact of the United States sabotaging its own spy mission to deep six the summit conference.
Worth noting, of course, that Already by 1959, the national security apparatus of the United States, or at least elements thereof, were already acting independently of the president's wishes and in direct contradiction of the United States Constitution. It's worth noting that one of the remarkable departures from standard operating procedure with the U-2 is the fact that someone obviously went out of their way to see to it that Francis Gary Powers would be very identifiable. None of the standard steps were taken to sanitize Francis Gary Powers, and Prouty also hints that a tampering with the hydrogen mechanism of the U-2 was responsible for its inability to maintain its altitude and consequent downing by the Soviets. And again, keep in mind that this was in direct contradiction of not only President Eisenhower's wishes and orders, but indeed in direct contradiction of the United States Constitution. And it's worth noting that the events surrounding the U-2 obviously were initiated by a very capable group of individuals. It certainly could not have been the work of one man.
Okay, another very important thing to realize while we're piling important things on top of you here is, as Dave said, the National Intelligence Network, specifically the CIA in this case, had long since become or considered themselves independent of the presidency. And another thing to remember here when we're talking about the CIA, except for the director who is appointed, we are talking about essentially a government civil service that knows no political affiliation in terms of being voted in or out of office. So a group that came in 1949 during the Red Scare were still around in 1959. Many of them were still around in 1969. Some of them were still around in 1979. God forbid a few of them may still make it to 1989. So we're talking about a perpetual group, not a group of office holders voted in and out by the whims of the Democratic public. Another important thing to realize is, as Dave said, not only had they become independent of Dwight Eisenhower, this goes clear back to the formation of the CIA and the inception of the CIA charter. The CIA, as many people fail to realize, a lot of people think the CIA is sort of like our intelligence army abroad, you know, fighting the Soviets, training radical groups, you know, to do this and do that. Well, that's in fact many things that they have become, but the CIA at its inception was supposed to be an intelligence gathering operation. The only part of the operation that was had any leeway as far as action was a very small subclause written in that the CIA could take whatever action was necessary in certain select circumstances to protect their intelligence sources. Well, the people in the secret team, if you want to put it that way, exploited this loophole to the point where the covert operations team, which was originally built on that tiny loophole, later became much superior in terms of clout within the CIA to the intelligence division itself, and in fact became the operant mode. And this is where quite a few of the people that have been termed as renegade agents or have been disavowed by the CIA in fact came from, and in fact most of them, many of whom are now called renegade agents, have continued to be members of the covert operations, but their very nature makes them covert operators. So this is something to bear in mind also. So clear back in the Truman days, at its very inception, the CIA had begun to break away from presidential control.
All right, now going again back to the U-2, recall that the summit conference, which would have cemented detente between Eisenhower and Khrushchev, was deep sixed. Obviously, it was the work of some sort of organization, either the U.S. national security apparatus as a whole or a large and controlling segment thereof. Now, this is worth noting for our purposes because the pilot of the U-2, Francis Gary Powers, who basically was shot down, imprisoned in the Soviet Union, and then came back to the United States. Upon his return, he co-authored a book with a man named Kurt Gentry, and among the things he intimated in that book were the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, later incorrectly accused as the lone assassin of President Kennedy, is attributed, the downing of the U-2 is attributed to Lee Harvey Oswald by Francis Gary Powers and others.
The other thing to remember is, as stated in Colonel Prouty's book, the Russians, the Soviets, however you want to phrase it, could not have shot down the U-2 if it had not descended. In other words, that although, as we'll hear Powers say, that he thinks it was betrayed to the Soviets, at that point in time, technologically speaking, the Soviets could not have gotten up to get the U-2, even if they'd known exactly where it was flying. The U-2 had to come down before shots could even be fired at it.
No plane or missile could reach the standard cruising altitude of the U-2.
All right, so now we're going to be listening to another segment from the same One Step Beyond. And
no, actually, this will be from the succeeding week. This will be September 11th.
Ah, okay. All right. My mistake then. And we're going to go ahead and listen to the One Step Beyond. There you go. Okay.
All right. Now what we're going to be doing here is reading, basically, you're going to hear Nip Tuck reading from a book called Operation Overflight. Now, Operation Overflight, as I just mentioned, was authored by Francis Gary Powers, who was the pilot of the ill-fated U-2 mission which scotched the impending summit conference. He wrote the book with a man named Kurt Gentry, last name G-E-N-T-R-Y. The book was published by Tower Books in paperback and copyrighted. My Roman numerals are a ways behind us, so I'm not even going to attempt the copyright date, but within the last 10, 12 years. So, basically, Tower Books is the paperback edition, Operation Overflight by Francis Gary Powers and Kurt Gentry. This from the One Step Beyond show of September 11th, 1983.
D7, the U-2s, that's the spy plane that Francis Gary Powers was flying, the U-2s were based in a new location at Sugi, Japan. In September of that year, a 17-year-old Marine Corps private was assigned to Marine Air Control Squadron No. 1, MACS-1, based at Atsugi. MACS-1, or MAX-1, was a radar unit whose duties included scouting for incoming foreign aircraft. Its equipment included height-finding radar. The private, a trained radar operator, had access to this equipment. He remained in Japan until November 1958, at which time he was returned to the United States and assigned to the Marine Air Control Squadron No. 9, MAX 9, at the Marine Corps Air Station at El Toro, California. El Toro was not a U-2 base, but U-2s frequently flew over this portion of Southern California. At El Toro, he had access not only to radar and radio codes, but also to the new MPS-16 height-finding radar gear. In September 1959, he obtained a hardship discharge from the U.S. Marine Corps. The following month, he defected to the Soviet Union. On October 31st, he appeared in the American Embassy in Moscow to state his intention of renouncing his U.S. citizenship. According to Richard E. Snyder, the second secretary and senior consular official, and John A. McVicker, Snyder's assistant, he mentioned that he had already offered to tell the Russians everything he knew about the Marine Corps and his specialty, radar operation. He also intimated that he might know something of, quote, special interest. His name, and longtime listeners of One Step Beyond have probably figured this out already, his name was Lee Harvey Oswald. 6 months later, says Francis Gary Powers, my U-2 was shot down. Oswald's familiarity with MPS-16 height-finding radar gear and radar and radio codes, the latter were changed following his defection, are mentioned in the testimony of John E. Donovan, a former first lieutenant assigned to the same El Toro radar unit as Oswald, on page 298 of Volume 8 of the Warren Commission hearings. According to Donovan, Oswald, quote, had the access to the location of all bases in the West Coast area, all radio frequencies for all squadrons, all tactical call signs, and the relative strength of all squadrons, number and type of aircraft in a squadron. Who was the commanding officer? The authentication code of entering and exiting, which stands for the ADIZ, which stands for Air Defense Identification Zone. He knew the range of our radar. He knew the range of our radio. And he knew the range of the surrounding units' radio and radar, unquote. Oswald's conversation with Snyder is mentioned at least three times in the report of the Warren Commission on the assassination of President Kennedy. Page 618, Oswald told him that he had already offered to tell a Soviet official what he had learned as a radar operator in the Marines. Page 665, Oswald stated to Snyder that he had voluntarily told Soviet officials that he would make known to them all information concerning the Marine Corps and his specialty therein, radar operation, as he possessed. Page 369, quote, he stated that he had volunteered to give Soviet officials any information that he had concerning Marine Corps operations and intimated that he might know something of special interest. During the 6 months following the October 31, 1959 embassy meeting, there were only two overflights of the USSR. The one which occurred on April 9, 1960 was uneventful. The one which followed on May 1, 1960 wasn't. Here the trail ends, except for one tantalizing lead discovered during the research for this volume. Among the Warren Commission documents in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. is one numbered 931, dated May 13, 1964. CIA National Security Classification Secret. In response to an inquiry, Mark G. Eckhoff, Director, Legislative, Judicial, and Diplomatic Records Division, National Archives, in a letter dated October 13, 1969, stated, quote, Commission Document 931 is still classified and withheld from research. The title of document number 931 is, quote, Oswald's Access to Information About the U-2.
All right, so a brief segment from a book by Francis Gary Powers with Kurt Gentry and his allegation, and it's a fairly subtle allegation, but the allegation is definitely there, that Lee Harvey Oswald, in fact, compromised and was responsible for the shooting down of the U-2. Now, a couple of facts that should be made clear very quickly. One, this book did come out well after the Kennedy assassination and the resulting brouhaha, so Oswald's name was not unknown at this point, and many other people were putting out things accusing Oswald of all variety of things. So it's not as if Francis Gary Powers can be given the nod for pinpointing Oswald ahead of the time. It was definitely part of a pattern.
That's important to know. This is a theme that's been sounded by the right in this country over a period of years. It's not hard to find articles attributing the downing of the U-2 and subsequent deep sixing of the summit conference to Lee Harvey Oswald. And this is interesting because now recall the material that Prouty presented about how Francis Gary Powers went on the flight with all kinds of identification, personal and organizational, which was done in direct contradiction of standard operating procedure. Recall the hint by Prouty that the hydrogen mechanism, which was used to restart the plane in the event of a flameout, had been deep sixed.
And the very flight itself was in contravention of Eisenhower's direct order as commander-in-chief not to compromise the summit conference, and that's a very important fact. I mean, that flight was put in the air deliberately in contravention of Eisenhower's order.
Notice that none of the information that Prouty talks about as being involved in the downing of the U-2 had anything to do with radar, any of the information that Francis Gary Powers charges Lee Harvey Oswald with being in the position to betray. And it's worth noting also that Richard Snyder, whom Oswald was interviewed, it later turned out was a CIA operative stationed at the Moscow embassy, and there are a number of sources for that, notably a book called Who's Who in the CIA by Julius Motter, but it's been well documented. And think about Oswald. Now, he supposedly had nothing more than an eighth grade education, and he was from the Marines. Now, could Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut who not only deep sixed President Kennedy, could he also have deep sixed a summit conference here? And, well, again, look at all the history that's being attributed to one man.
That again from the Guns of November, Part 1, from November 1st of 1983. And again, in addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of my charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck. Now, again, Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty would have looked at Edward Snowden and his operation in the way that a veteran intelligence officer would have looked at it. He would have noted, first of all, as we have spoken about in the past, among other articles talking about this, is in 2009, Ed Snowden said leakers, quote, should be shot, unquote. Then he became one by Joe Mullen, M-U-L-L-I-N, from Ars Technica, of June 26th of 2013. This is exactly the period, the summer of 2009, when Ed Snowden decided to become a, quote, leaker, unquote. What was he doing, and who was he working for? Quote, hired by the CIA and granted a diplomatic cover, he was a regular old IT guy whose life was elevated by a hint of international intrigue. He was working for the CIA. And Fletcher Prouty, again, as a veteran intelligence officer and analyst, would have looked at Snowden, understanding that he was a spook, and would have instinctively and explicitly disregarded the superficial persona of Ed Snowden and his statements for the general public, because spies do not represent themselves as being what they are. They don't wear Delaney tags. Hi, my name is Ed, and I'm working undercover for the CIA. It doesn't work like that. He would have disregarded the public persona and statements of Edward Snowden and looked instead at the reality, as we have seen in the past. And again, the whole Snowden op is so complicated and with so many levels, I can't begin to do justice to it here. But he would have known that Snowden is an extreme right-winger who favored getting rid of Social Security, bringing back the gold standard. This is Mr. The elderly wouldn't be effing helpless if you stop sending them effing checks so they can sit on their A-blank-blanks and lie in hospitals all day. A verbatim quote from Edward Snowden when he was posted in 2009 by the CIA to Geneva, Switzerland. He was on a chat group. He is an extreme right-winger, and probably would have noted that, and would have noted the profound links between Edward Snowden and the campaign of Ron Paul. Not only did Snowden give money to Ron Paul's campaign, and not only does he espouse the same kinds of views, but the chief legal counsel for Ron Paul's 2012 campaign, a guy named Bruce Fein, was Edward Snowden's first attorney, and is the attorney for the Snowden family. Now, again, looking at what Snowden did and comparing that with the U2 conference and noting what has taken place since, Snowden goes from, he is working for CIA and then basically obtains 1.7 million, I've seen it also as high as 2.7 million secret documents about the NSA. He could not have reviewed all of those documents himself. And I've done a little checking around, and people knowledgeable about such things, I can't cite you a printed source, but laughed off the possibility that Snowden could have gotten those the way he said he did, by basically convincing coworkers to give them their passwords for their secret email accounts, etc. It can't be done that way. Snowden could only have gotten the 1.7 or 2.7 million documents when directed by one or more major intelligence service. So he goes from Hawaii to Hong Kong, courtesy of Jacob Applebaum, about whom we'll hear more later, just as Obama is going to meet with President Xi of China to basically work out some accords on mutual spying and hacking that was then severely damaged. We now see the U.S. engaging in both an economic offensive, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which excludes China, and military confrontations between the U.S. and China about China's maritime activities. China is beefing up some artificial man-made islands, and we're told that the U.S. is confronting these in order to basically, in accordance with the United Nations Protocol on Navigation of the Seas, its exact name escapes me. The problem is that the U.S. never ratified that treaty. And so Snowden's trip to China has been followed by both an economic and military, economic and military offensive, not as yet, hopefully never a shooting war, but basically military confrontation and economic offensive against China. I would also note that with the concentration of economic ownership around the world, with the top 1% of the world's population controlling more than half of the world's wealth, basically making them wealthier than the bottom 99%, and as Oxfam disclosed, in addition to that, the richest 62 people on Earth control more wealth than the bottom 3.6 billion. The capabilities of damaging the Chinese economy by a relatively small number of investors is quite large. Also, China is challenging to a certain extent the U.S. with regard to its currency and banking operations. China's minimum wage is too high for the tastes of the transnational corporations, and they want to begin setting up their sweatshops in other Asian countries. So again, following Snowden's trip to Hong Kong, which damages U.S.-Chinese relations at the very same time that Obama is meeting with President Xi of China, we then see a U.S. military and economic pressure on China. Then Snowden, of course, goes to Europe, just as Obama is going, Snowden, but just as Obama goes to Europe, Greenwald, whom we have seen, is again, the opposite of what he is represented as being. He's a shiller for killers, and he discloses information about U.S. spying on Germany. Then Snowden, courtesy of WikiLeaks, goes from Hong Kong to Russia on the eve of a summit conference between Obama and Putin. That is the end of that summit conference. That is the end of the U.S. reboot with Russia, and It was followed by the Maidan coup and the war in Ukraine. That, in turn, that hot war, that military pressure, is also accompanied by U.S. sanctions against Russia, which is causing tremendous economic hardship in Russia. And so, again, the Snowden op, the L'Affaire Snowden, the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, and the Obverse Oswald, first to China, then to Russia, and in both cases preceding and foreshadowing U.S. economic and military pressure on both Russia and China, two of the main components of what I have called the Earth Island. Another key article from Rolling Stone of December 4th of 2013. Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald, the men who leaked the secrets. This is a puff piece, but it notes that it was in 2009 at the same time that he was posted to Geneva, Switzerland for the CIA that Snowden decided to leak these documents, whereas previously he was a cynical, hardcore fascist who basically referred to Ben Bernanke as that C blank 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 bag who was going to magically print $1.2 trillion, basically the same sort of voodoo economics that the Republican Party is giving voice to now. And the guy who said basically the elderly wouldn't be helpless if you'd stop sending them effing checks so they can sit on their A blank blanks and lay in hospitals all day. All of a sudden, we are to believe that the angel of mercy landed on his shoulders, imbued him with the spirit of humanity, and then resolute in the spirit of self-sacrifice, vowed to risk all on behalf of his fellow human beings about which he cared so deeply. Probably would not have taken that at face value. He would have seen that as what it quite obviously is, which is a cynical spook operation. I call Snowden the Obverse Oswald because whereas Oswald was the front for an intelligence operation infiltrated into the Soviet Union, given a pro-Castro cover, and then framed for the assassination of JFK and killed before he could defend himself, Snowden is also fronting for an intel operation, except he is being portrayed as a hero. Hence my nickname, one of my nicknames for him, the Obverse Oswald. And Pravi also would have noted Snowden's spying on the NSA while working for the CIA. And for some perspective on that, we are going to go into a very important book about the JFK assassination called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. That was published in soft cover by Touchstone Books and authored by James W. Douglas, copyright 2008 by James W. Douglas. And in that book, there is discussion of the setting up by Colonel Pravi of focal points, and it reads as follows. One man in the position to watch the arms of the CIA proliferate was Colonel Fletcher Pravi. He ran the office that did the proliferating. In 1955, Air Force headquarters ordered Colonel L. Fletcher Pravi, a career Army and Air Force officer since World War II, to set up a Pentagon office to provide military support for the clandestine operations of the CIA. Thus, Pravi became director of the Pentagon's focal point office for the CIA. CIA Director Alan Dulles was its actual creator. In the 50s, Dulles needed military support for his covert campaigns to undermine opposing nations in the Cold War. Moreover, Dulles wanted subterranean secrecy and autonomy for his projects, even from the members of his own government. Pravi's job was to provide Pentagon support and deep cover for the CIA beneath the different branches of Washington's bureaucracy. Dulles dictated the method Pravi was to follow. I want a focal point, Dulles said. I want an office that's cleared to do what we have to have done. An office that knows us very, very well, and then an office that has access to a system in the Pentagon. But the system will not be aware of what initiated the request. They'll think it came from the Secretary of Defense. they won't realize it came from the director of Central Intelligence. Dulles got Prouty to create a network of subordinate focal point offices in the armed services, then throughout the entire U.S. government. Each office that Prouty set up was put under a cleared CIA employee. That person took orders directly from the CIA, but functioned under the cover of his particular office and branch of government. Such breeding, unquote, Prouty said decades later in an interview, resulted in a web of covert CIA representatives in the State Department, in the FAA, in the Customs Service, in the Treasury, in the FBI, and all around through the government up to the White House. Then we began to assign people there who, those agencies, were from the Defense Department, but they actually were people put there from the CIA. The consequence in the early 1960s, when Kennedy became president, was that the CIA had placed a secret team of its own employees throughout the entire U.S. government. It was accountable to no one except the CIA, headed by Alan Dulles. After Dulles was fired by Kennedy, the CIA's deputy director of plans, Richard Helms, became this invisible government's immediate commander. No one except a tight inner circle of the CIA even knew of the existence of this top secret intelligence network, much less the identity of its deep cover bureaucrats. These CIA focal points, as Dulles called them, constituted a powerful, unseen government within the government. Its Dulles-appointed members would act quickly, with total obedience when called on by the CIA to assist its covert operations. Prouty would have looked at Snowden and seen it against the background of the focal points that he helped to create. And I would point out that the CIA and other Western intelligence services are, as we speak and for quite some time, have been using Islamists from the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, elements of that are operating in Syria, apparently spawning ISIS, as proxy warriors and as elements to bring corporatist economics to the third world and the Muslim world in particular. We have spoken about that at great length in many shows, including our many programs about the Earth Island Boogie. Ultimately, there are a number of things that would have been necessary, I think, for the CIA and for the transnational corporate interests in the underground Reich that the GOP slash bad guy element of the CIA would want done. Recall in our conversations with John Loftus, there are basically two CIAs. One, which is much smaller, is basically democratic with a small d in orientation and is associated with the Democratic Party. The larger one, much larger, is affiliated with the GOP and the transnational corporations, and it is explicitly opposed to democracy and is not acting in America's interests. With NSA capable of doing the things that it is doing, the ability to, well, to monitor the CIA's manipulation of Islamists would be something the NSA could do. I would note that in a Washington Post article, basically, Walter Pincus noted that the documents that Edward Snowden gave to the article is from the Washington Post of December 18th of 2013, an article by Walter Pincus, Snowden still holding the keys to the kingdom. And he writes, on July 14th, the Associated Press published a story in which Greenwald said that Snowden, then in Moscow at the airport, had literally thousands of documents, unquote, that constitute, quote, basically the instruction manual for how the NSA is built. Greenwald, who said he had spoken to Snowden hours earlier, told the AP that in order to prove his credibility, Snowden, quote, had to take ones that included very sensitive, detailed blueprints of how the NSA does what they do. These documents, Greenwald said, would allow somebody who read them to know exactly how the NSA does what it does, which would in turn allow them to evade that surveillance or to replicate it. I think anyone who might be willing to blow the lid on the CIA's manipulation of the very Islamist proxy warriors that are spawning the terrorists who are bedeviling the U.S., well, this would give CIA and also BND a way of neutralizing the NSA and holding their feet to the fire should anyone within the agency or the agency itself be inclined to blow the whistle. People like Grover Norquist, an early opponent of NSA spying, are part and parcel to the Muslim Brotherhood, proxy warriors, and corporatist economics. I would also note the things like the downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 in Ukraine, the shootdown of the Russian fighter bomber by Turkey, are things that NSA would have information about, and yet we have heard nothing from NSA. And I wonder to what extent the Snowden op has basically compromised NSA. Also, the powers that be very much want there to be a big, big war. And Obama doesn't want to send in U.S. ground troops, although he is allowing Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia to pretty much do what they want. That helped to spawn ISIS, as we have seen. In order to get the American people to fall in behind a massive U.S. Ground operation in the Middle East, something is going to have to happen, whether it would be a series of San Bernardino-type incidents or a massive bloodletting along the lines of or even larger than September 11th, seeing to it that the NSA would not blow the whistle on something like that, and there might be people within it who would not want to see thousands or perhaps even millions of Americans killed. Well, this would be one way to see to it that NSA would be compromised. We're going to conclude by a look at something else that Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty would not have failed to note, which is the CIA and intelligence affiliations of the very people that are the leading advocates for Internet privacy. In the written description for the record 891, which will be available later today being February 25th of 2016, there are a number of tweets by Jacob Applebaum singing the praises of Gene Sharp, whose theories served as the foundation for many of the Conga Line ops that I spoke about in For the Record 885. We're going to conclude with excerpts from an article, all of which is in the written description for the show. Internet Privacy, Funded by Spooks, A Brief History of the BBG, that stands for Broadcasting Board of Governors. This is by Yasha Levine from the Pando Daily of March 1st of 2015. For the past few months, I've been covering U.S. government funding of popular Internet privacy tools like Tor, CryptoCat, and Open Whisper systems. During my reporting, one agency in particular keeps popping up, an agency with one of those really bland names that masks its bizarre, wild history, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, or BBG. The BBG was formed in 1999 and runs on a $721 million annual budget. It reports directly to Secretary of State John Kerry and operates like a holding company for a host of Cold War-era CIA spinoffs and old-school psychological warfare projects. Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, Radio Marti, Voice of America, Radio Liberation from Bolshevism, since renamed Radio Liberty, and a dozen other government-funded radio stations and media outlets pumping out pro-American propaganda across the globe. Today, the congressionally funded federal agency is also one of the biggest backers of grassroots and open-source Internet privacy technology. These investments started in 2012 when the BBG launched the Open Technology Fund, or OTF, on the initiative housed within and run by Radio Free Asia, a premier BBG property that broadcasts into communist countries like North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, China, and Myanmar. The BBG endowed Radio Free Asia's Open Technology Fund with a multi-million dollar budget and a single task, to fulfill the U.S. Congressional Global Mandate for Internet Freedom. Skipping down, though many of the apps and tech backed by Radio Free Asia's OTF are unknown to the general public, they are highly respected and extremely popular among the anti-surveillance internet activist crowd. OTF-funded apps have been recommended by Edward Snowden, covered favorably by ProPublica and the New York Times technology reporters, and reportedly promoted by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Everyone seems to agree that OTF-funded privacy apps offer some of the best protection from government surveillance you can get. In fact, just about all the featured open-source apps on EFF's recent secure messaging scorecard were funded by OTF. Skipping down. Readers might find it odd that the U.S. government agency established as a way to launder the image of various shady propaganda outfits is now keen to fund technologies designed to protect us from the U.S. government. Moreover, it might seem curious that its money would be so warmly welcomed by some of the Internet's fiercest anti-government activists. Skipping down. Jacob Applebaum's financial relationships with various CIA spinoffs like Radio Free Asia and the Broadcasting Board of Governors go further. From 2012 through 2013, Radio Free Asia transferred about $1.1 million to Tor in the form of grants and contracts. This $1 million comes on top of another $3.4 million Tor received from Radio Free Asia's parent agency, the BBG, starting from 2007. Skipping down again. You'd think that anti-surveillance activists like Chris Segoyan, Jacob Applebaum, Cory Doctorow, and Julian York would be staunchly against outfits like BBG and Radio Free Asia and the role they have played and continue to play in working with defense and corporate interests to project and impose U.S. power abroad. Instead, these radical activists have knowingly joined the club and in doing so have become willing pitchmen for a wing of the very same U.S. national security state that they so adamantly oppose. Fletcher probably would ask whether they were perhaps members of those focal point networks he set up so long ago with Alan Dulles. Well, that's all we have time for today, boys and girls. But be sure to tune in for the next exciting episode of The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, your favorite cartoon character. Remember, boys and girls, Eddie's not like those other spooks. They're scary and mean. Eddie is your friend. This concludes For the Record program number 891, How Might Colonel L. Fletcher Proudy Have Viewed Edward Snowden, subtitled, The Foxes Aren't Guarding the Henhouse, They Are the Hen House, Part 2, Update on the Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook. This is being recorded on February 25th of the year 2016.